Hello and welcome to The Documentary here on the BBC World Service. I'm Kavita Puri and this is £3 in my pocket. Over the next hour, I'll be bringing you the untold stories of an extraordinary group of people. They're the pioneer generation from the Indian subcontinent who came in the 1950s and 60s to find work in post-war Britain. They arrived with just a few coins in their pockets, £3 to be precise. That's less than $10 at the time. But it was these men and women who led the way for the 3 million people of South Asian descent who live in Britain today.
I came to UK on 14th November 1959.
My father, Ravi Dutt Puri, still has the passport he came with on that day.
Government of India wouldn't give more than a few pounds to each person. They normally give £3.
It's not much, is it, to start a life?
It was quite a sum at that time, but not to live here.
Ask any elderly Indian who came to work here in the 50s and 60s how much money they came with, and they will most likely tell you £3. I grew up with their stories of a generation that arrived with nothing and made a life, a good life for themselves in their adopted country. Kulwant Selly took the boat from Bombay in 1954 on his 18th birthday.
When you go to this passport officer in Calcutta and he said you only allowed by law £3, I asked him, this £3, what is going to buy me? He said, oh, don't worry. He wrote down £3 on it and he put the stamp on it and he signed it underneath.
And in those days, 1954, yeah, what could you get for £3?
For 2 pennies, you could get a loaf of bread, bottle of milk, was 6 pence. You could get a bag of potatoes for 1 shilling, might get you more than just over a week for rent and the food.
Professor Gurupal Singh from the School of Oriental and African Studies.
In the 1950s and 1960s, India, like most developing countries, faced an extreme shortage of foreign currency.
His father came to Britain with £3.
And in order to ration what limited currency there was, a strict quota was imposed, namely that anyone who was leaving the country would be limited to £3. And that was an extremely small and meagre amount.
Those coming from Pakistan in the 50s could bring little more. Muhammad Ajib remembers he came in the winter of 1957 with a few pounds extra.
I flew with £5, with a thin suit, with a trunk. It took 24 hours from Karachi to Heathrow Airport.
The rains come to India. It's the monsoon season, and all the time the bloodshed goes on. As the new dominions of Pakistan and India take over their own affairs, communal hatred flares up in the Punjab. Fleeing from their looted...
The partition of India in 1947, which followed the end of British colonial rule, left 1 million dead and many more refugees. There were few economic opportunities in the newly created independent states of Pakistan and India, but Britain's 1948 Nationality Act gave all former Commonwealth citizens, that is, the people of its former colonies, the right to settle in the UK, and it was this that started the first significant wave of migrants from the subcontinent. There were already some 5,000 Indians resident in Britain, those from the British Indian Army, sailors or Lascars as they were known, who'd settled in the ports of London, Glasgow, Liverpool and Cardiff, working as peddlers. But the early 50s saw a dramatic increase in men, and it was almost entirely men at that time, who came to settle in Britain. My father, Ravi, a mathematics graduate, who'd worked for a number of years for Pfizer in India, thought there'd be better opportunities for him in Britain. Aged 24, he came here in 1959 to be a graduate trainee at Dormelong Engineering in Middlesbrough, in the northeast of England.
So I reached Heathrow Airport in the afternoon and I was very disappointed to see all these customs were in single story shed. Indeed, there I was further disappointed to see that There were only single-story buildings, not very posh, because we were told England's beautiful wide roads. But in fact, in New Delhi, there were much better roads.
A prospective colleague was meant to meet my father at the airport to take him to Middlesbrough, but never showed up. So he made his way alone.
The train which was going to Middlesbrough was the last train. It was very cold. I didn't have overcoat.
So what were you wearing then?
I had my suit. I felt so cold. So fortunately, I had a dressing gown which I had bought. And I put it on and I was walking on the platform in the dressing gown.
And what did people say when they saw you?
Here they don't mind.
It's just a strange image of you walking around with a dressing gown. And how many suitcases did you have?
One.
He caught the last train and sat in an empty carriage for the length of the journey, in his dressing gown for warmth. Arriving at Middlesbrough station, he caught a taxi with the address in his hand to his new digs, where weekly board and lodgings to his English landlady was £3.
I rang the bell. Nobody opened the door.
What time was it?
5 and 6 in the morning. Then the milkman came to deliver milk. And he saw my attaché case with labels. And he said, "Have you been traveling?" I said, "Yes." "From where have you come?" I said, "India." "So why are you standing in the rain?" I said, "I pressed the bell. Nobody opened the door." He said, "That's very strange. It is cold. You haven't got overcoat." "Okay, not to worry." He put his hand on the bell and started singing. And he didn't stop ringing the bell until the landlady opened the door. She said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Puri." So went inside, got hot drink, and she served me breakfast, went to bed. For about 4 or 5 days, I was at home. And it was so miserable, raining all the time, no sun whatsoever. And it's nearly a week now. I have found that the sun never rises in the British Empire.
Everybody had their own perception that England is a very beautiful country, and if you blow your nose, you could be fined. If you spit on the road, you will be told off.
Kulwant Seli's father was waiting for him when he arrived by ship from India at London's main port in 1954. He was greeted with a surprise.
When I came to England and landed at Tilbury, it was 5th of November. There was a lot of fireworks going on. And I asked, "Do they celebrate Diwali here?" And my father said, no, this is Guy Fawkes." I said, "What is Guy Fawkes?"
Muhammad Ajib arrived in November 1957 from Mirpur in Pakistani-administered Kashmir, a region the majority of the Pakistanis in Britain originate from. He made his way from Heathrow Airport to Nottingham in the East Midlands to the one person he knew in England. He spent his first shilling on a hot chocolate from a vending machine at St Pancras Station to keep warm.
My first journey from London, St Pancras, to Nottingham Midland Station. I was shivering with cold and I was sitting in the train. A gentleman came. He appeared to be a very professional person with his hat on and well-suited and his umbrella in his hands. So he sat down. He asked me a question. He said, "I'm sure you feel cold." I said, "Yes, sir, I feel cold because it's first day in this country." He said, "Where do you come from?" I said, "Pakistan." He went outside, he bought a cup of coffee, gave to me. Still, that didn't help me. And then he opened his small briefcase, got traveling blanket out, and he wrapped me around. I was moved by his kindness. I've never forgotten him.
That English gentleman, Muhammad Ajib, had just met by chance, put the new arrival into a taxi and paid the fare to his new home. There he found his house was full of men from Mirpur.
This particular house was shared by 28 of us. It had 4 bedrooms and a living room and the front room, and they were all used as bedrooms.
So how did you do it?
4 in one bedroom. Or sometimes some people were on shift, and during the day, when they vacated their beds, then the people on night shift, they used to sleep on those. I mean, the conditions were atrocious. A, we could not pay much rent. And B, the indigenous white people, they didn't want us. And in the shops, the adverts displayed freely saying no blacks, no darks, no Irish, if they were advertising a flat or a house. And I'll tell you something else. Half of us caught tuberculosis, and some of them spent about 6 months in a sanatorium.
It's hard to believe that at this time in Britain, it was legal to refuse housing, employment or public services on the grounds of colour, race or national origins.
The back of this house, you have a huge big garden, tennis court.
And is there a swimming pool out back?
So you've got a swimming pool on there, or you got a sauna, got a jacuzzi on the side.
Quite a long way from your house in Shoreditch.
Oh, yes, yeah.
The extravagant house is a far cry from Gerbershard Bantz's first home in England in the East End of London in 1955. He was 13 back then and arrived with his father from Haryana on the border of the Punjab, an area torn apart by partition, where many of the Indians living in Britain today originate from. His father came for a better life and to give his son an education.
The house was all in pieces. There was floorboard, no liner. There was a hole in the floor. The wall was no plasterboard, only gas light in there. We have never have had central heating. And I was really surprised that we have to live in this sort of conditions. Because we are living on very low rent, we have to accept this sort of property. House was really described as not for human being.
And what kind of home had you had in India?
My father had a big house. We had a 5-bedroom house with a 2 entrance each side, 2 floor, big veranda upstairs. We had electricity on those days as well.
The special skills of Birmingham's foundries and machine shops can be learned, and there's every encouragement for the coloured worker who's eager to learn them. Indians and Pakistanis have won for themselves...
After the Second World War, Britain needed workers from its former colonies to work in its factories and foundries, as well as the newly established public services like the National Health Service. The 1948 Nationality Act was passed to give former Commonwealth citizens unfettered access to enter Britain. Professor Gurupal Singh.
After the end of the war, there was major effort in terms of rebuilding existing industries and the commitment of the government, of course, to full employment. And this created a significant shortage of manpower, especially in the manufacturing sector. For example, in the foundries in the West Midlands and in the mills in the north of England.
Many went to Coventry, where there were a number of industrial factories. Darshan Singh came in 1950 and worked at the Stirling Metals Foundry. His young daughter Paula joined him in Coventry in 1953. She showed me his photograph.
That's my father, and that's me. I must have been about 9 then.
Father looks like a proper English gentleman in his suit.
He is an absolute English gentleman when you look at him. He had 2 top hats on top of the wardrobe in boxes, which he used to wear on a Saturday or Sunday, especially when he went to the pub. And he used to dress in a very smart suit. Father was like a film star, like Paul Newman.
Darshan Singh did one of the hardest jobs at the foundry.
When he came on his bike in the evening, covered in dirt, he worked in the furnace. It was the worst job in the whole foundry. He came home and I can actually remember him coughing up blood.
It made him ill?
I think he was an extremely strong person, but he worked so hard. His overalls used to be washed on a Saturday, and they'd be soaked on Friday. And on Saturday, they'd be soaked overnight, and my mum used to be scrubbing them on a scrubbing board. And it was so hard to clean them. And I used to feel so bad.
Why did you feel bad?
My dad was such a hard worker. He didn't have to work that hard.
Why was the furnace work the hardest work at a foundry?
He couldn't speak English. He couldn't read or write. And that was the best paid job for what he was capable of getting. And he had to sometimes bribe the person who gave the overtime by getting a bottle of something so he'd be given the overtime.
For extra money after working his long shifts, he would buy and repair old TVs with an uncle.
They bought a whole load of televisions and radios at the auction, and they decided was they're going to repair them and then sell them. And they did one up for us as well. We thought it was absolutely wonderful.
What would you watch?
Pinky and Perky after school, the test card thing, and the news, little bits of news, I remember.
That brings us to the end of our evening. Thank you for your company, and may we now wish you all a very good night.
And then the national anthem at the end when they closed the BBC. And I'd say we have to stand up for that.
Would you stand up?
Oh, yes. We all had to stand up because I said we have to stand for the national anthem.
Your mum, your dad, they stood up?
Yes, they did. They said, well, no one's watching. And I said, well, we're supposed to, even if nobody's watching.
In the early 50s, the numbers of those coming from the Indian subcontinent were still relatively small. In 1951, the government estimated that 43,000 South Asians were living in Britain. For its public, seeing them could be something of a novelty. Kulwant Seli, by then living in Charlton, South London, remembers.
I was the only Indian and a Sikh in the whole area. When I used to walk in the street, a lot of young children used to walk behind me and they used to say, are you the Maharaja? They looked at my turban. They think that only Maharajas wore the turban.
Gurpashad Bance remembers the kindness shown to him in the first few years of his arrival, when as a young man of 14 and 15, he worked as a peddler, selling knick-knacks and clothes door-to-door in East London.
We used to sell shirt, cardigan, ties. It was easy to sell those days.
And people bought from you?
Yeah. As I was young, come inside, get your hand warm. Now tell us what your problem is.
So people would invite you into their house?
Yeah.
English people?
English people. It happened a lot. As we go along, people was friendly as well as cruelty was there as well. Because 57-58, people was coming from abroad. And they would start hating people.
By this time, no longer a novelty, he was not being invited into English homes. By the end of the decade, immigration from the Indian subcontinent had more than doubled. Government estimates in 1961 were around 112,000 settlers, and the atmosphere in some places had begun to change.
In 57, me and my father bought a house in Stepney Green. More or less, I think, in 1 year, we had 7 times broken window. They throw brick in through the window every time. Quite a few times when I go to work, they grab me on the way.
Who's they?
These English boys. What are you wearing this? You got a sore head or this sort of thing. You know, they keep calling you black dog and things like that. Or they take your turban off.
You took your turban off?
Knock your turban off. But you got a headache for it. We went through a lot of things.
What would your English neighbours say when they would see the windows smashed in your home?
They were very sorry for us. They said they would like to catch them. But few of them was same time other side. They were with them. You shouldn't be here. Go back to your country. You not belong to here.
In 1957, Mohammed Ajib was one of a handful of Asians living in Nottingham. His first job was making bath cubes, but he didn't manage to hold down his job for long.
They did not treat us well at the factory. My machine, there was out of commission, and my foreman sent me to another department. And he said, you clean that, you sweep that. I was doing all these things. Then he said, you go on that big machine. He said, you got to clean that. Then he shouted at me, hey you, and I heard him. I didn't pay any attention. Then he came to me and he tapped on my shoulder. He says, I'm talking to you. I said, I'm not your dog. I'm a human being. He said, oh, Johnny boy. I said, what? He said, go home. So I went home. No hearing.
So you were sacked?
I was sacked. Instantly, yeah.
In 1958, the Indian Workers Association provided a national body to improve conditions for immigrant workers like Mohammed Ajib. It worked alongside the mainstream British labour movement. Back in South London, Kulwant Seli's father had helped him to secure a sought-after apprenticeship at an electrical company. He worked by day and studied electronics by night.
56, 57. A lot of these people used to watch the television and they used to show this KKK, Ku Klux Klan, and a lot of these English young people of my age, they used to also practice that type of things. And I remember one day, this fellow came to me, he said, you black man, go back to your country. I argued with him. And he really hit me so hard in my ribs that it nearly killed me. And I fainted. I could tell you that, you know, how much hatred it was.
And what did your bosses say?
Well, you dare not to tell anybody. If you do, there will be a big gang of these people in the company. You know, we'll sort you out. We'll sort you out later on. Things like that.
And were there other Indians who worked with you?
No, I was the only Sikh or the Indian person who worked there.
So when this incident happened and this man punched you, how did that make you feel about being in this country?
For a few weeks, it was very, very hatred I had it. But then I came home and told my landlady what had happened because I was in a lot of pain. And she had a word with her husband, and they both sat together and talked to me, and they said, just keep quiet and just take it on the chin.
Something new and ugly raises its head in Britain. In Notting Hill Gate, only a mile or two from London's West End, racial violence. Police reinforcements are called up to check the riot.
One of many that... In 1958, riots took place in Notting Hill against the Afro-Caribbean community, but they also had a wider significance for other migrant groups from the former colonies. Dr. Florian Stadler from Exeter University in England and co-author of Asian Britain explains.
The Notting Hill riots are a crucial turning point in the way in which Britain perceives the migrant communities, but also the way in which it perceives, I guess, an idea of the empire coming home, which is premised by the large-scale migrations that happened post-1948. And this manifestation of that fear leads us to the direct consequence of the 1962 Immigration Act.
This act restricted universal settlement. From 1962 onwards, you needed a work voucher to settle in Britain. But the act had unintended consequences.
The 1962 Act and the anxiety of the voucher system very much led to Asian pioneer settlers, workers in the UK, to bring their wives, children, next of kin over into the country.
Official documents from the time show nearly all the men who came for work never intended to stay. But once here, with little money and restrictions on Commonwealth citizens beginning to be imposed, the myth of return became just that, a myth. All the men we spoke to decided to stay and made successful lives for themselves and their families. We're taking a break now for the news, but after that, we'll hear how they progressed, how one became Britain's first Asian Lord Mayor, and another a prize-winning engineer. And we meet the wives and children that joined the pioneer men.
The BBC World Service.
We have the headlines.
Democracy protests have spread to new parts of Hong Kong.
But we go further.
I am on a pedestrian walkway looking down into the sea of people that have taken to the streets here. People as far as the eye can see, thousands of them.
Telling it how it is.
I'm right on the border between Turkey and Syria, and within the last few minutes, two very large explosions heard just a few hundred metres from where we were standing.
Giving people a voice.
I tried to stay positive, although I was scared when I saw my relatives dying in front of me.
Looking to the future.
The Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has appealed to all countries to help fight the Ebola virus.
It is the duty of all of us to send a message that we will not leave millions of West Africans to fend for themselves.
BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
Hello, I'm Kavita Puri and welcome to The Documentary here on the BBC World Service. Coming up after the news, more from £3 in my pocket, the untold story of the men and women who came to Britain from the Indian subcontinent in the 1950s and 60s. They're the pioneer generation who came with just a few pounds. And after so long in this country, where do they feel they belong? That's £3 in my pocket in a couple of minutes.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. More than 3 million people have marched through Paris and other French cities in a show of unity after last week's deadly attacks by Islamist extremists. The French government said it was the largest rally in the country's history. President François Hollande, alongside 40 world leaders who linked arms, said that today Paris was the capital of the world. French people of all faiths and ethnic backgrounds marched in honour of the 17 victims of the attacks on the magazine Charlie Hebdo and a Jewish supermarket. Many carried placards saying, "I am Charlie, I am a policeman, I am a Jew." Among those at the rally in Paris were several leaders from the Middle East, including the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Later, President Hollande joined the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the Grand Synagogue for a remembrance ceremony for the four Jewish victims of the supermarket attack. Rallies to show solidarity with France have taken place around the world. Thousands of people gathered in Brussels, Berlin and Vienna. In London, top monuments were illuminated with the red, white and blue of the French flag. In other news, two female suicide bombers have blown themselves up in northeast Nigeria. At least four other people were killed when the explosions ripped through a crowded mobile phone market in Yobe State. An eyewitness told the BBC the bombs went off within a minute of each other. Poland is evacuating almost 200 Ukrainians of Polish descent from eastern Ukraine, where separatist conflict is simmering. They've been taken out of the troubled Donetsk region after months of planning. More than 50 people in northeastern Mozambique have died after drinking contaminated beer at a funeral on Saturday. 70 others are still in hospital. Officials believe the beer, a traditional Mozambique drink made from millet or corn flour, had been poisoned. BBC News.
Welcome back to £3 in My Pocket on the BBC World Service, the story of a pioneering generation who came to Britain from the Indian subcontinent in the 1950s and 60s.
Let's just look at the back of your passport. And there's this stamp here. Can you just tell me what this is?
That's £5 amount we are allowed to convert Indian rupees into pound we can carry with us, no more than
that. And how come it's £5?
Three for me, two for my daughter, who was 2.5 at that time.
Those arriving from the Indian subcontinent to Britain, like Gunwant Grewal, were allowed to bring as little as £3 into the country. This is their story, the men and women who paved the way for the more than 3 million South Asians who live in Britain today.
I couldn't believe a country could be so grey and dull. That gave me a little bit of shock.
I would have fish and chips in the newspaper, and even now I love chips, yes.
The lady said that her husband did not want us there because you people breed like rabbits.
I realize it's better here. I feel much better and free.
At the beginning of the 1960s, there was much anxiety in Britain at the increase in the number of migrants coming from the former colonies. Parliament passed the first Commonwealth Immigration Act in 1962, which led to restrictions against an open-door policy. But the arrival of the women from the Indian subcontinent was an unintended consequence of the legislation. It gave the male migrants a choice: bring their wives over or return home with little certainty that they could come back. Here's Professor Gurpal Singh, who we heard from earlier in the programme.
What the Act did was create a sense of fear that there would be further legislation and indeed that it may not be possible in the future to bring one's children and wives over to the UK. So there was a lot of anticipatory migration occurring as a result.
The Act meant that from now on, if you were coming to Britain, you needed a voucher to work. Gunwant Grewal, a qualified teacher, came from Calcutta in 1965 on a teaching voucher.
I got married and gone to live in a big city. I'm from a village. I was stunned. My in-laws got lots of money, but no education sort of. So I feel really suffocated. So I mentioned to my brother, I said, look, it's not really that good. He said, you know what, there's some leaflet that the British government need teachers. Why don't you apply it? I said, okay, do it, just like this. And because they need teachers within weeks, I've got a voucher from England.
And just to show me this voucher, because you've kept it amazingly.
I think this is the one, yeah.
And it says the British Ministry of Labour.
On those days.
And it was issued on the 4th of Feb, 1965. So this voucher enabled you to come...
as a teacher.
Her husband had come a few weeks earlier with £3 and found a home in Southall, London, for his wife and young daughter.
You will surprise how many people in that house lives. In the front room, husband and wife, nighttime sleep, daytime the sitting room. And the back room downstairs, there was a Chinese young couple with the two little boys. Upstairs front room was for me, my husband and my daughter. In the back room upstairs, there was two Muslim men. In the box room, there was one young Indian bus driver.
All the occupants shared a kitchen. Back home, Gunwant Gruwal was used to having servants.
I remember he used to do cooking in the evening and leave the utensils, and in the morning they're still there because nobody washes it. Then my landlady said, you had to wash it, they're yours. So I said, oh, it's hard in the beginning, but you slowly, slowly get used to it.
21-year-old Inderjit Seli arrived in 1961 to stay with relatives in Birmingham in the Midlands. She intended to study at Cambridge University, but once here, her relatives recommended a marriage to a young Indian engineer, Kulwant Seli, who we heard from earlier in the programme. He'd arrived in England with £3 in 1954. As newlyweds, they lived with their in-laws but wanted a place of their own and responded to an advert for rented accommodation.
The lady said that her husband did not want us there because... we are newly married, obviously we are going to have children. She used her own terminology. You people breed like rabbits or something to that effect.
What did you think when she said that?
I thought I wouldn't want to live with them. And that is when we decided that we definitely are going to buy our own house.
In 1961, it was still legal in Britain to discriminate on the grounds of race, colour or nationality in housing. In the early days after their arrival, and without their family support, many of the women felt a profound loneliness. Gunwant Gruwal desperately missed her father. She sang folk songs to herself to assuage her homesickness.
My father wrote me, he said, tell me how your life is. My tears was on my letter, when I was writing it. I told him, I said, you know what, the room I'm living is much, much smaller than our kitchen. Back home, my father said, why your letter was with them? Then I said, oh, I was having a cup of tea. But really, it was tears. In the beginning, I missed them. But then slowly, slowly, things got better.
Are you remembering those days?
I know, I know.
Did you never think, come on, this is too hard, let's go back home?
In the beginning it was like honeymoon period, come here for a few years, then we go back. But then I realized that my in-laws got lots of money, so we will have the money to live, but no freedom. So I realized it's better here. So I feel much better and free.
Gunwant Gruwal, who was a qualified teacher back home, found it easier to get a job as a worker in a tea factory. But as soon as her supervisor realized she could speak good English, she was given a sought-after position weighing out tea for the tea bags, which other colleagues resented.
One English girl, she said to me, why the hell you got this job? You haven't got blue eyes. She means that you are Indian, and how could you have a better job than us? I didn't say anything. I was a little bit stunned. And then she said, why did you come here? I wasn't very happy. I said, okay, give me the fare. I'll go back home tomorrow. Then she walked off. But it was that much prejudice. But I was very naive and simple. I didn't take these things to heart, sort of. But there was nice people, very, very nice as well. My supervisor, she adopted me like a daughter. So it goes both ways.
But she made friends with some of her fellow factory workers and was able to have frank conversations about how to avoid getting pregnant, a subject considered taboo in the Asian community.
I asked those English girls, I say, what do you do? She explained me everything. She said, if you by mistake become pregnant, you can have abortion. I didn't know what abortion means and how you go about it. And I said, my husband won't let me do this sort of thing. She said, there's another way. Then I inquired how to go to the clinic to ask for family planning without my husband knowing.
So you kept that from him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He will have killed me.
Were you curious as to why English families had fewer children than
India? I was pleased and surprised. How come? I didn't know family planning in those days.
Rooney Saeed came from East Pakistan in 1968 to be with her new husband. Their arranged marriage had been conducted on the phone while she was at home and her husband was in England. She'd been a principal at a school in Dakar. One of her first jobs on arrival was at a betting shop in London as an administrator, but it was contingent on one thing.
The condition was that I couldn't wear sari. I got to wear skirt. That was a shock. I never wore skirt, and I'm a Bengali Muslim woman. I can't do that. But the job was lucrative. It was £7 a week. My husband didn't get £7 a week. And a lot of people say, oh, that's very good money. So I said, okay, let me buy a skirt, put the skirt underneath the sari, go to the office, take my sari off, have the skirt and go and sit down. You got to have a skirt and tight blouse, which I did, but not on the way home.
Promotion at work was difficult. Inderjit Seli, now living in London, was working in the civil service in 1966. She recalls a conversation with her boss when she asked him if she could apply for the next grade.
I asked him, would he recommend me? He said he would never recommend me. I said, why not? And his answer was, number one, you're Indian means non-English. Number two, you are a woman. And either way, there is a problem. So I said, well, Indian Prime Minister is Indira Gandhi. Head of the England is a queen. So if a woman can be queen of UK and an Indian woman can be prime minister of India, why can I not go to the next grade? So he said, no problem with you, but people may not accept you. I said, in that case, it's those people who should be educated. Why should I be kept behind?
But 2 years later, in 1968, the Race Relations Act finally made it illegal to discriminate on the grounds of race for employment and housing, significant rights for migrants. But despite these positive changes, Indians and Pakistanis took little comfort. This was also the era when Conservative politician Enoch Powell gave his controversial Rivers of Blood speech, warning the country was building its funeral pyre in allowing so many immigrants into Britain. The numbers coming with their origins from the Indian subcontinent were increasing. From the mid-60s onwards, many were also coming from East Africa. It caused much public debate and led to further legislation.
It is generally agreed that the immigration bill is an unpleasant measure, but equally so it is agreed that it is a necessary step. The plight of immigrants is...
The 1968 Immigration Act imposed further curbs on Commonwealth citizens. It was introduced amid concerns that up to 200,000 Kenyan Asians fleeing repression would take up their right to reside in the UK. By the end of the decade, the number of migrants with their origins from the Indian subcontinent had increased fivefold in 10 years to around 500,000. But many of the new arrivals made life harder for those already here. Inderjit Seli.
It did make the difference in the sense that whereas before we were just a few and the English community was more inquisitive, but now seeing so many people come over, they were seeing them everywhere. So number one, the curiosity was no longer there. And secondly, it seemed that English people were now starting to see Indians and immigrants as, are they going to overtake us? Are they going to make this country inundated with the foreign population? So that kind of feeling started to come up. Whereas before we were Indians, now with people coming from Africa and everywhere, we all started being classed as immigrants rather than Indians as Indians.
The idea of Britishness was a distant, luxurious concept. The community was coping, struggling with everyday life amidst the growing animosity. Runi Said remembers that time.
The atmosphere was not quite encouraging or accepting. You just live your life separate from the home community. It's a kind of parallel life we had. We didn't want to interfere. Most of the families, they wanted to kind of establish themselves. They were struggling to settle.
This was Britain, 1968. Yet talk to this £3 generation today, nearly 50 years on, and they have very different feelings about their country, no longer living a parallel existence. And over the decades, as these men and women have worked to redefine themselves, a confidence about who they are has emerged. Their years of hard work, of building careers and lives, has given them a stake in Britain, one which helps them deal with hostility when it arises, in a different way now to the way they may have done 50 years ago. So this is your front garden. Tell me what you've planted here.
We've got some daffodils coming up and crocuses.
Indrajit Seli came in 1961 and was to go on to enjoy a successful career as a senior civil servant. She remembers one particular incident which occurred as she tended her flower beds in South London a few years ago.
I was working in the front garden one day and a couple of young boys walked past and one said to me, "Why don't you go back home and leave our country alone?" And he walked past. And I got up and I said, "Come back. You said something. I didn't quite catch it." They came back. I said, "Well, I'm here in this country making a house in your country look more beautiful. I said, why don't you come and help me to make your country more beautiful rather than walking around on the street?" So they didn't know what to say. They moved on. See, about 10 minutes later, they came back. And they said, "What do you want us to do?" I said, "Well, I'm tidying up the borders. Come and help me, and I'll give you the money for that." They said, "Okay." So they helped me to clean the front garden borders. They didn't take any money from me. They went away. A week later, a lady knocks at the door, and she said, "Are you the lady who told my boy to do some work in the garden?" I said, "Yes." Said, "Thank you for that, because now he's making up his own bed in the room and started tidying up."
How extraordinary.
So you never know what is going to happen.
Many of this £3 generation we spoke to were born in British-ruled India. They made the country of their former colonial ruler their home. But when more of your life has been spent in Britain than the place you were born, who are you? And where do you belong? My father, Ravidutt Puri, came in November 1959, aged 24. In the following decades in Britain, he had a successful career as a prize-winning engineer.
Looking back on yourself, that young man who was wearing a dressing gown, do you just think, "I can't believe I did that journey"?
I feel proud that I did that journey. I feel proud that I still made it. If you are a strong person, you will do it. How did your spelling test go?
Well,
what was the hardest word you had to spell?
Sailor. S A
yes.
I
yeah. L O R. Very good.
My father has lived in Britain for over 5 decades, even though he thought he'd only be here for 2 years.
When you think of home, what is home to you? Is it here or is it India now?
Now the home is where my children are, grandchildren are. At that time, I was single, so my home was where my parents were. With the time and circumstances, it can change.
But can you, as a first-generation immigrant, ever feel you belong anywhere? Is there always a feeling of otherness? Paula Sangera, who came as a child in 1953 and became a deputy headmistress.
I don't feel I fit anywhere, really. I'm a one-off.
And do you mind?
It's very uncomfortable, and it's very lonely sometimes, because my way of thinking is different from people who grew up in India, from my generation. I find it very difficult to communicate in the same way, on the same level. And I'm different from English people, and I'm a bit of a loner. But as I got older, I feel more of an outsider.
Does it matter, though, if you're an outsider? In a way, you can easily fit into lots of different societies, and that's a good thing.
Oh, I can.
You don't feel like you belong anywhere?
Yeah. When we go to India, I feel as if I'm a tourist. The Indians there, even family, they've said, you know, we can just look at you and you are different. You might dress, you might speak exactly the same as us, but you're different. They sense it.
Professor Gurupal Singh.
It's the unsettling otherness that is always present when critical events occur. The passing of one's parents when I visit India, or when something major, significant happens, for example, in the Sikh community. For example, the storming of the Golden Temple in June 1984 by the Indian Army, which had a significant impact on the self-consciousness of the Sikh community.
I'm British Bengali now, but Bengali is 90% and 10% British, in the sense I do accepted many values like freedom, speaking out. You can do whatever you want to if you want to do it.
Where do you think you belong? Where is your heart?
It's become concentrated in family. We plan to go back to Bangladesh when we retire. We didn't. I couldn't leave my children, now grandchildren. There is a root in a foreign land. It's as if I'm a tree and rooted in this British land. And I have got all my fruits and flowers in my tree, my children, my family, my friends. So I cannot uproot that. 2-3 times we went to Bangladesh, bought a house, then we sold it, bought a flat, sold it. We never seem to uproot ourselves and replant that tree in Bangladesh.
Runi Saeed, who has lived in Britain for nearly 50 years. Others also feel their identity is clearly rooted here. Gunwant Gruwal had a job for decades with Customs and Excise, and Mohammed Ajib, who started work in a soap factory, became Britain's first Asian Lord Mayor.
I was someone who was born in Pakistan. Sometime, I have nostalgia. I go back to my birthplace. And I have that bit of emotional attachment with that place. But if I go there for 2 months, I can tell you honestly, I feel homesick. I want to come back to Bradford. It's a great city. Britain is a great country. It has given me everything. I love it. I'm proud to be British. I cannot be English.
Do you feel that you belong
yeah.
to this country?
Yeah, of course I do. This country has given me everything. I did not get anything from Pakistan. This is one of the greatest countries to belong.
Do you feel that you belong to this country?
Oh, yeah. I belong in this sense that I had more happiness from this country than I ever would have from my own people, my own country, if I stayed.
So England is your home?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't even want to go to India. No way. I've got no interest whatsoever.
I lived in this country over 60 years now. I left India at the age of 18. So most of my life is in England. I am Indian, born Indian, lived in England. Now my home is England, so more of my heart is in England now.
Kulwant Selly, who became a college lecturer. But the recesses of your subconscious can be revealing. His wife, Inderjit Selly.
I do feel British because I'm living here for the past nearly 53 years, and it has become part of my breathing, for instance, the way of life and everything. But deep inside, I would say I'm definitely very much an Indian. To give you a very small example of that, I have spent a lifetime working with numbers. And of course, we have the calculators now. But when it came to doing the numbers on my own, I always reverted back to my Punjabi times tables and adding, subtracting. And I still am the same. I definitely inside am 100% Indian.
My father, Ravi, surprised me. I know he'd never go back to live in India and loves the English countryside and dresses in a three-piece suit, but he is very clear on who he is.
There has been no change and there is no need to be any change.
Do you feel British?
I still feel Indian so far as my blood and soul is concerned. There is no change whatsoever. First Indian, then British.
But do you feel that you belong to this country?
No, I do. Professionally, you couldn't be any better anywhere except this country.
In this programme, I've heard from the men and women of the £3 pioneer generation, of their first steps in this country, and their reflections of their life here many decades on. Their stories are not just their own, but a part of Britain's history and its identity. Mohammed Ajib and Kulwant Seli.
When I came, we did not have anything to give to this country other than our sweat and blood and labour. Now, some of our people, very successful economically, and we're giving back to this society. We went through many, many difficulties. There were many, many twists and turns in our lives. There were many, many difficult tasks we had to perform in this society. We have established for the coming generation, the first generation I'm talking about now, homes for you, temples for you, mosques for you, businesses for you. And then what you're doing is you're building upon those foundations. You can build a very tall building.
I am one of those pioneers of that time. All those people who came during my time, they worked very hard. They came and they lived in 3 to a room, 4 to a room, and they wanted to buy their own property at the end of the day. A lot of people wanted to send the money back home because they had poor parents or they'd taken the loan to come to this country to pay up those loans. But they worked day and night and worked very hard. They achieved themselves something on their own, and that is what is very important.
I had one final difficult question. When you've lived a life apart from the place you were born, for Hindus and Sikhs, where would you wish your ashes to be scattered? Kulwant Seli and Gunwant Grewal.
All my family's ashes went to India in Punjab. And I like to be with my family, with my parents, my brothers and sisters, and my ashes to be taken and dispersed over the rivers where my parents and my sister, brothers, ashes were dispersed.
Some people say, when you die, your ashes go to India. I say, no, I told my children, I said, when I die, you must take my ashes to Blackfriars Bridge. I worked there, that was my office. I had the best days. So I said, you must take my ashes between Blackfriars Bridge and Waterloo Bridge, put it in the Thames.
£3 in my pocket was presented by me, Kavita Puri, and the producer was Smita Patel.